He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people.
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the American Centrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Captain Kidd, John Hawkins, Walter Raleigh, Sir Francis Drake, John Paul Jones. These are all names that we associate with the peculiar practice of privateering. Privateering was a quasi-legal form of piracy that had been practiced on the high seas for centuries before the War for Independence, and indeed was practiced by both sides during the war itself. How did it work? Well, during times of war, a ship's captain could be given a license to roam the seas in search of enemy merchant ships. Upon discovery, the privateer would seize the vessel, its contents, and its sailors, and return them to a friendly port where the ship and contents would be sold to the highest bidder. The spoils would be shared then amongst the captain and his crew, with a fee going to the sovereign that granted him the license, be it a king, a nation, or even a colony like Connecticut or Virginia. Furthermore, privateers could be used as a supplementary navy, as Queen Elizabeth called them, and their purpose was to destroy ports, raid towns, and wreak general havoc on shipping. British American captains and sailors had mastered the art of privateering well before the outbreak of the Revolution in 1775. In fact, for decades, American colonial seamen, working as British subjects under the British king, had engaged in privateering during the various wars in the 18th century, including the Seven Years' War. After the outbreak of the War for Independence in 1775, the Continental Congress and some colonies started to issue privateering licenses to Patriot captains, so they could raid Loyalist towns, capture British merchant ships, and disrupt British supply lines. The British Navy, of course, was doing the same to Patriot towns and ships. And here we see in Grievance 24, he has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. So this practice of privateering had profound effects on the war. So today we'll be discussing privateering and a number of issues connected to it. How is privateering used by different imperial powers in the Atlantic world? How is it connected to the shipping industry and different boycotting policies before and during the American Revolution? Why did British privateering appear as one of the grievances against King George in the Declaration? How was privateering used by both sides in the war? And how is it connected to the slave trade? And here with me today to answer these questions is Professor James Fischter. Welcome, James.
Thank you very much for having me.
James Fischter is Associate Professor of History at the University of Hong Kong. He specializes in Atlantic, maritime, and international history, and the connections between early America, the British Empire, and the world. His book, Tea, Consumption, Politics, and Revolution, 1773 to 1776, was published by Cornell University Press in 2023, and a link is in the show notes. So, James, let's start with that passage from the Declaration, Grievance 24. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. Why did you choose that passage to begin our discussion today?
I like this passage because it gets at many different implied pieces that are buried within it. You know, on one level, it's an indictment of the king and really Parliament as well, or simply no longer treating the American colonists as British subjects. He's inflicted the Navy and Army upon the public and the populace rather than using it to protect them. Now, this is the ultimate betrayal of subjects by sovereign, and therefore deeply justifies independence. In the time that this is written, British forces were known to have caused the destruction of two North American towns, Falmouth in what is now Maine, and Norfolk, Virginia. And these were well-known events of considerable large-scale destruction, and these are implied, these two towns' destruction, in this claim. Of course, as we discovered 200 years later, Norfolk, Virginia was actually burned down by patriots who then successfully blamed the British for doing this. And we didn't even work this out until the early 2000s. But that's okay. It was good politics and good PR at the time to burn down the village and blame the enemy. So
specifically the Scots, right? They're blaming the Scots tobacco traders.
Yeah, Scots tobacco traders were heavy in Norfolk. And you know, Norfolk was a deeply loyalist town. So anyone with a little bit of critical thinking skills could have asked, why, oh, why did the king's armies burn down a loyalist town? In fact, probably one of the strongest loyalist outposts in Virginia. Why do this? But in any case, the commanders of the Continental of Patriot Forces reported back deceptively to their commanders, indicating that the other side had done it. Both sides had burned down some homes in town, and then the wind had favored the fires started by the loyalist and British forces. Well, in any case, there's a lot more to it than just that. This is about the king's command to shut the ports of North America and to command basically to blockade North America and command the Navy to arrest North American shipping. This was also a very odd thing to complain about because North Americans had already blocked shipping with Britain in their previous boycott of the previous October, the Continental Association. So what the king was doing was saying, well, if you're not going to trade with Britain, we're not going to let you trade anywhere else. And so this is another complaint that's embedded within this. And then, of course, finally, the monarchy is unleashing and licensing privateers to attack North American vessels. And this creates a new space for undermining the continental effort. But when you think about it more broadly, the commercial violence that is inflicted by privateering, it's easier to do it with a bigger merchant navy, and it's more attractive to do it against an economic power that has a lot of wealth at sea in shipping and trade. So this was a strange moment. In previous wars, the extensive North American shipbuilding apparatus, where there were lots of tall trees, you know, Britain had a lot less shipbuilding, had a lot less good wood for building trees than New England did. There's good shipbuilding opportunities in New England and elsewhere, and they supported the British efforts, as you mentioned, in the Seven Years' War and others. But now, suddenly, this developed shipbuilding industry can be weaponized against one of the largest shipping industries in the Atlantic world, which was the British commercial industry of the shipping industry of the 1770s. And so going after the sugar trade out of the Caribbean, going after the slave trade to the Caribbean, these are all things that are much more lucrative for the Americans to do in attacking the British, and not nearly as lucrative for the British to do in attacking the Americans, because British shipping is simply more affluent, more developed, and larger than North American.
That's fascinating, and there's so much to unpack there. So let's just start unpacking the basics first for our audience. So the first question I had was about the plundering of our seas, ravaging our coasts, burning our towns, destroying the lives of our people. Was there any like clear separation between what the Royal Navy could do in its destruction and what a British privateer could do? Or was it such a loose distinction that anyone pretty much could do anything against Patriot towns, shipping, and villages? Was there like some sort of clear, I'm thinking in modern terms of like rules of engagement or something for a privateer versus a naval ship?
You know, the privateering courts tended to be very generous in interpreting prize cases and almost always ruled in favor of the prize taker, whether it was an American, British, French, Spanish, Dutch privateering court, all the same. And so rules of engagement in that sense didn't really operate as a meaningful constraint on privateers. The most meaningful constraint on them was risk versus reward. And so privateers almost never attacked Navy ships of a foreign Navy because that ship would have more decks, more cannons, more men, and would simply be too dangerous to attack, and also have less economically rewarding cargoes on board. On the other hand, I came across in archives in Connecticut privateering records, prize court records describing little rowboats that were called whale ships that rowed across Long Island Sound and raided the loyalist refugee encampments that had formed on Long Island. Loyalists had escaped from Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Rhode Island to Long Island, and then patriots raided them. So in these accounts, They row across the water, and then they just loot the shop of people they know. They're going for some guy they know full well who's a sergeant or a captain in that loyalist force.
It's like the LA riots or something.
Yeah. Well, I think more than that, I think they know, I suspect that these are people who know the guy, who hate him personally, and he maybe had been a loyalist in their colony, and he fled and became a loyalist officer in the army, in the, a loyalist militia in New York colony, and therefore now they're mad they're going to get him. And then so they row back with some bags of salt and some flour and some plates. In a way, it's kind of petty. And salt is not petty. Salt is a way to preserve food over winter. But some crockery and some dishes as a loot is quite petty. But sometimes they would also just steal the humans, the slaves that these loyalists owned as well. And it was just, and it's bizarre because they would land, and you don't picture a privateer getting off the ship and walking up the hillside. They would land. They would march up the hill, go to the fellow's house, rifle through his house. That's not, to me, privateering is supposed to involve being on a boat or a ship of some sort. Being on the water is a requirement for privateering. But this was, you know, there was a bit of a shore party going on, and they went out and they did this. Now, navies also do this, right? They send crew on shore to conduct shore actions, but limited, right? Short in duration, keeping the main body of men on the ship, and you want to make sure that you don't stay too long in sort of naval thinking. Privateering too. Easier to raid some guy's house, right, than it is to raid a more established settlement or something. So this risk-reward ratio works in a lot of different ways. And then the court didn't really ask a lot of questions. It didn't provide an opportunity for the loyalist in question to come across with a parlay flag and to dispute the property or anything like this. There was no opportunity to prove he was or was not a loyalist. There was no opportunity to prove he did or did not own the things that they claimed to have taken from him. The libelant was just, which is what you call the prize taker in a court. The libelant was just generally believed and got away with it, accurately or not.
Yeah, it's funny. This was a settling of scores, though, for, finding a specific loyalist that you don't like, figuring out where he lives, and then you settle the score. And what's also, again, it's serious, but it's also humorous that what we're doing is talking about theft or piracy, but there's this huge legal apparatus behind it to justify it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas simple theft in not times of war would simply be theft, and piracy would be piracy and potentially would be executed for it. But during times of war, it's basically okay. Now you mentioned early in your discussion there, the different courts, the different privateering courts would hear these disputes. So obviously an English privateer defending his privateering in an English court for stealing something from the Dutch, okay, they're going to side with the Englishman. But what if an English privateer was captured by the Dutch? Would they be treating him as a pirate or some legal combatant?
So you see these cases of ships that are captured and recaptured, often on unfortunate cases where it's 3, 4, 5 times back and forth, the same ship. Because when you think about it, less likely the privateer than the prize, where the privateer is taken, the privateer is at sea, it encounters an enemy merchant vessel, it takes the vessel, and it tends to want to take a vessel that it can take quickly and without much resistance, because resistance might damage the cargo. So they don't want to have to fire too many cannon shots at it, right? God forbid they sink the vessel, and then they can't bring it bring it into a court and extract value. So then they board the vessel. Now they need to crew and operate the vessel and sail it into port. And this is tricky. They have to have been overstaffed, overmanned previously, and then cut back on the number of crew on their main vessel and put some more personnel on this other vessel to control it, and enough crew not only to sail this vessel, but also keep an eye on the original crew of that vessel who are now you're going to take as prisoners, just to return them. You're not going to keep them permanently prisoners, probably. They're just civilians, but you don't want them to rise up and take the vessel back. But they might. That might be one reason it changes hands. But then this prize vessel is under the staff on this prize vessel is low in total manpower, and they could easily be retaken by an enemy by another privateer on the other side or by a naval vessel and back and forth several times. You know, there's this famous case in 1781 of the Zong. This is a Dutch, it's called the Zorg initially in Dutch. It's a slave trading ship that the British take, and they take it as a privateer. The British privateers take. They take the slaves. They're in off the west coast of Africa. They load additional slaves on it that they've taken from elsewhere, and they try to sail it across the ocean to get to the New World to sell them. And it's a weird case because they crammed too many people on the ship and therefore had to murder over 100 of them to drown them in order to get the rest to port with enough water, or they, at least they thought they had to do this. And so it's a just famous case in terms of the anti-slavery movement. Abolitionists would in Britain latched onto this. But it's also very striking because, you know, it shows it's this outlier in terms of how privateering works. It was not how most privateers operated. They wouldn't want to sail their cargo across the ocean like that, right? But they probably, I haven't looked into it closely, but my bet is that they didn't have enough personnel to control multiple vessels. And so this is one reason why they condensed. They tried to jam all the enslaved people into one vessel. But it's also a sign of how widespread this is, right? The British are doing it to the Dutch. The French are doing it to the British. The Americans, the Spanish all get involved. And as these other powers, these continental powers get involved in the war, it opens up many more lucrative privateering opportunities. If American privateers have to put in Charleston as the southernmost port, maybe Savannah, that they can operate from, much of the Caribbean is vaguely accessible, but also vaguely out of reach. And the kinds of shipping you're going to get are the ships that go from Jamaica past the Bahamas back to Britain with sugar and coffee. But if your privateers can put in at Martinique or Guadeloupe, then they can get the slaves that are coming into the Caribbean. You know, if you start being able to base yourself in Saint-Domingue or Cuba, you can have different opportunities in terms of the kind of shipping you can raid. And so the continental powers' Caribbean possessions become a vehicle for this expansion of the war. You know, arguably the most important theater of the war was the Caribbean. This was economically where the most important colonies for Britain and France were, and therefore it mattered more to them to not lose important colonies in the Caribbean than it did to lose or keep something like Virginia. And also privateering options were bigger there because of the greater value and wealth of those colonies.
Something that you said there I found quite interesting. The fact that these cargoes and ships could be changing hands so many times. I recalled the case of one American colonial sailor who changed sides 12 times on different ships because he was captured by one and then taken by the other. And it seemed that there was a separate brotherhood of the sea. Mm-hmm. Everyone knew that everyone was in it for this sort of game that was being played of stealing each other's shipping. No one was going to like execute the other crew. None of that was going on. They would be given opportunities to join and maybe get part of the spoils if they were a seasoned sailor who literally knew the ropes, as they said. And it just seems like, in a certain respect, a very civilized form of raiding on the high seas, where you'd just be like, okay, this is mine now, but we're not going to harm you or treat you poorly. You can even join our side. And, you know, we're not going to necessarily have any animosity towards you for being on an enemy ship. You're just a sailor, just like me. Is that the sense you get from some of this, or was there any like animosity and hatred?
I think there's a skill shortage. And the Royal Navy for years, right, has been doing impressment. One of the grievances at the time of the American Revolution is the press gangs that roamed North American ports. Of course, almost many of the grievances that North Americans expressed in the Declaration of Independence also happened in Britain. The press gang was among those things that existed in Britain and Ireland too. But the press was especially focused on getting skilled men who had worked on civilian merchant marine ships that knew the ropes, as you say, that knew the winds and tides and knew how to operate a gun or a cannon reasonably well. They were valued skilled men. And so there is that. And then you can see this from other directions. This was a very multiracial population of men. It was not at all exclusively white. It was very black and brown as well. And in addition, it was multilingual. There were lots of Portuguese, French, other sailors in ports coming and going who were drawn upon, including some slaves who worked as sailors, which is sometimes you can seem mind-blowing because you'd think, wouldn't they be able to leave? This would be a good opportunity. So it's very striking in that way. And there is a body of literature that talks about this as sort of a proletariat of the sea, right? As sort of a working class common space. And yes, they didn't really seek to slaughter each other, partially because of a brotherhood, but also there's no self-interest that is served by attacking these other people. So they didn't.
Fascinating. Okay, I know you wanted to discuss the concept of boycotting in the various trades. So why don't we just move on to the discussion of the shipping industry and boycotting politics mm-hmm. next.
Yeah, the American Revolution is one of the earliest moments where you really see a meaningful boycott politics forming. The word boycott is from a later century. It's from Irish politics in the 1860s. So the literal use of that word is different. But they called it non-importation, non-exportation, and non-consumption. And these added up to boycotting, refusing to trade, and not simply refusing to trade with another place on a governmental level, restricting trade, but asking individual people to make a choice to participate in not buying, not selling, not consuming goods to or from this other place. So this kind of politics is new, and it's a part of the politics of the rebel movement in the American Revolution. It's not really part of the politics of the British side. And so the striking thing is we've seen over the last generation of scholarship this emerging argument that there was a sort of a way in which colonists voted with their wallets and purses. And this is a very interesting and compelling argument because it gives us a way to see how non-jurors can participate in politics, non-voting persons. So women can participate in politics simply by managing the household purchases, even if they are not themselves able to vote or in New England to speak in town meeting or something like that. And of course, across North America, there were serious property qualifications that restricted voting as well. But you can have consumer politics and boycott politics that would allow people with less property or no property to still have some sense of stake in that way. And so this has been a very compelling, that sort of the protest of consumers who refuse to consume, kind of a way to look at it. But at the same time, we've been missing, when we look at it that way, the way in which boycotts are very tough. They're very tough to manage. They're tough to maintain. They're difficult to implement and get going. It's difficult to figure out when to call a stop to them. And many boycotts don't work very well or don't achieve the goals that they set out to do, or they fizzle out. Sometimes even boycotts that are famously well regarded may have had other factors helping them along. For example, 1989 was when the apartheid South African government decided to allow democratic elections. How much of that was because of the boycott, and how much of that was because it was the end of the Cold War and they could no longer count on U.S. support to the same level?
And it's fascinating because I guess in the modern world, we would talk about something like ethical consumption, like yep. make sure your coffee is from a fair trade coffee producer in Central or South America. Let's make sure that the fashion we buy isn't made by enslaved children in Bangladesh. And, you know, like the most recent one would be the Tesla. Now affectionately known on the left as the swastika, hysterically. But again, how effective is it? I mean, you would say there are just as many people buying a Tesla now or whatever, and just as many people are buying non-fair trade coffee. But, you know, it's like, I understand what you say. At a certain point, how do you, as a historian or even an analyst, try to figure out how much is this consumption by choice or avoiding things by choice affecting any actual economic or political decision making?
Yeah. And another layer of that is, you know, for the participants, how do they know what to believe? Are your organic bananas really organic? Or are they just labeled organic? We choose when we do something like buy organic bananas because we prefer organic, we're choosing to believe and trust in the label we see there. We're not verifying it. We're trusting in the supply chain. And so you see, you know, John Adams comments one time having tea with John Hancock, and he comments in his diary, he hopes the tea was smuggled, but he doesn't know. And so, you know, he hopes it was organic, but he isn't sure, but he's going to have it either way. And so there's a problem because the merchants of this period are slippery fellows, and they're willing to repackage Dutch tea as British or British tea as Dutch, depending on what is needed. Earlier boycott movements of tea, for example, focused on British tea and not Dutch tea, and so it was easy to swap between them. And when the Continental Association gets going and they ban trade with Britain, British Caribbean colonies or West Indian colonies, and other British colonies that don't join, like initially Georgia, the Floridas, Quebec and Nova Scotia, and of course Ireland, they ban imports and exports of these places, consumption of their goods. Well, how do you know, even if you do that, how do you know the coffee is from Saint-Domingue and not Jamaica? You don't really know. Also, this other problem crops up of how do you know the people in the other colonies are still adhering to the boycott? Because this collective action problem emerges where if you start to disbelieve that the other people are adhering, you start to think that the other people are cheating, then you think, well, why shouldn't I have this forbidden product as well? Why shouldn't I benefit from it? And so the clever, funny thing about the boycott is the Patriots announced this boycott with great fanfare, and they have bonfires burning undesirable things, tea, British and Loyalist newspapers, acts of parliament, books. There are a striking amount of book burnings in 74 and 75. Nevertheless, these are performances, not lived daily realities. People show up to the crowd and they burn these products to show they don't like them. They show up to be seen, especially if you're a suspected person. Sometimes these performances went differently. I read about a case in New Jersey where they did a big burning, a tea burning, and then one fellow filled his pants with tea that he stole from the bonfire. So some people are going to the bonfire just to steal goods. And his name became a joke around town. His last name was Stacks. So he got known as Tea Stacks for the stacks of tea that he took. This implies a certain play, right? A certain gap between what people are saying they're doing and what they're actually doing. And we know this happens all the time. Politicians do that every day. Why should we assume that average colonists and subjects and citizens wouldn't be the same?
Well, one of the big sort of misconceptions, I think, of the revolutionary period is that there was ideological purity anywhere. I mean, sure, there were the true believers. A certain percentage were true believers on either side. But even you look at someone like Benedict Arnold, you know, he was on one side and then thought that, you know, the revolution had accomplished what it ought to, and then became a general on the other side. And now, of course, in our romanticized version of history, he is the great traitor, but he was a great patriot general first. And again, your example is great. There are lots and lots of people who would participate in things for some advantage to themselves. And of course, the loyalty oaths would be a third example. If the British Army has a bayonet in your face, you're likely to sign an loyalty oath, but as soon as they leave, maybe you're going to renounce that oath. And of course, the fourth example, which we discussed today, was this American sailor who changed side 12 times on 12 different ships just because it was convenient. So I think this concept of ideological purity in the revolution is totally misguided. What do you think?
I do. And, you know, I think the loyalty oaths are a great example. So when they implement the Continental Association is the boycott that Congress announces in October of 1774. It is Congress's response to the Boston Port Act, which has closed the town of Boston, and the remainder of the coercive acts. And so it is primarily a boycott. It is a boycott of trade with Britain, Ireland, British North American and West Indian colonies that don't join Congress. So basically non-associating colonies are all boycott as well. And so this becomes on one level a lever to force neighboring colonies like Georgia to move in. You must continue trading with South Carolina. Georgia has to switch sides from the British to the American side to do that. But, you know, it's not just this ban on trade, import and export. It's a ban on consumption. It's a ban, the second article of the Continental Association, strikingly, it bans the slave trade, which is an unusual thing to ban. And ever since W.E.B. Du Bois's thesis on this in the late 19th century, everyone has generally come to the same conclusion that it's really weird, because not only does it ban the slave trade, but no one talks about it. No one, like, there's almost no comment at the time about banning the slave trade, not from these proto-abolitionists in the North, not from slave owners or slave trade merchants in the South. No one wants to talk about it because it's a weird coalition of people that like this. And it's better to just basically say, to use this, it's a political document, the association. So basically they can say, we're not doing the slave trade, and blame Britain for it. And of course, the early drafts of the Declaration of Independence do try to blame the king for the slave trade. So there is this weird sleight of hand there. And one article, the association bans tea, all tea. They try to do some political economy to mandate, to try to reduce the amount of animals that are slaughtered so they can be husbanded and increase in number. I think they focus on sheep. They restrict luxury consumption. There are shows of being not overly showy in the way you dress, right? Of being more restrained and not elaborate in funeral attire and things like this. But this gets to this gap between rhetoric and reality, which is an old article title, but also just performed behavior that you do in public and what you really do in private. And so with the association, after it was announced, Congress announced this, and then it sidestepped all the colonial governments and directly asked the county or town level patriot authorities to implement the association directly around, so they didn't have to wait for different levels of control. In many regions of North America, where there hadn't even been much patriot organizing before. And so this was a solicitation for patriot movements to emerge. And for example, central and western Pennsylvania, backcountry North Carolina, and places like that. And these patriot committees emerged, and they would take a sheet of paper and they would go around town and they would ask people literally to sign the association. We don't have any of the signing sheets anymore, but they would send members of a local patriot organization around town, around the parish, around the county, asking people to sign up to this association, to say they agreed. And you look at the sheet of paper and you see the names of people you know, people that attend your church, back when church was 6 hours on Sunday, people that shopped at your shop or to whom you owed money or who owed you, people who you had personal relationships with, who knew your wife, who were related to your in-laws. The men who came to your door were people you knew or knew of, who commanded some respect in town. Perhaps they were militia captains. And so they asked you to sign. And you saw the sheet, and you knew that if you didn't sign, the absence of your name would be noted by your neighbors and friends. And so you signed. This isn't unusual. This isn't new. This is a very sort of community-based consensus politics, where consensus basically means the dissenting minority agrees to shut up about the fact that they don't agree, because it's not productive to continue doing so. That's a different kind of politics from the sort of permanent opposition minority view that we sort of see about dissent and disagreement today. But it was quite normal at the time. You know, if you think about a lot of these Moravian or Mennonite or other communities that form throughout North America, they often were governed by some sort of leadership that was quite strict in what you were or were not allowed to do, yet nevertheless had consensus, so-called consensus, right, in its actions. So therefore, people agreed to say they supported the association. And the great clever move of the patriot leadership was that they agreed not to check. So they said, okay, we'll take for your at face value your claim that you're going to join the boycott, and you will now politely not violate it in public in a way that would force us to act. And the Patriots get all sorts of people who are informing on each other, saying this person's a loyalist, this person's a boycotting, not doing the boycott. But if you're really not going to do the boycott, if you're really going to consume something that's forbidden, you do it at home. You do it in private. And they're not sending inspection committees door to door. If they had done so, they would have made themselves obnoxious, because that was exactly the kind of officious overgoverning that Patriots were complaining about the king and parliament doing. So it was a sort of a political sleight of hand. And then the second sleight of hand was they didn't have to manage the boycott, because the crown's closing of the seas, the waging, plundering our seas, ravaging our coasts, this enforced the boycotts for the Patriots. So they didn't have to do that much enforcing. The king did it for them. And then when they did start raiding British ships and getting British supplies that they'd seized from the British, well, of course, this coffee from Jamaica is okay to drink if we privateered it,
because
right?
Because we plundered it.
Yeah, we plundered it. So it's anti-British to drink this Jamaican coffee now,
it's
right?
It's the tastiest of teas.
Yeah, or this East India Company tea that we nicked off that English ship over there. That's good stuff. We're going to drink that. Why not? Because, of course you are, because you're also taking the blankets from the British supply ship that were going to go to the lobster back army and putting it on the backs of Patriot soldiers instead. And the guns and gunpowder were not the guns of Ticonderoga good enough for George Washington's army. He didn't boycott those. So, of course, the guns and gunpowder and rifles and everything else that they take, the potatoes and the coal that they need for their armies, surely civilian supplies too. So that there becomes this sleight of hand in the boycott on multiple levels.
The American Patriot privateers acted as not only a real threat to British shipping, but they also had this important political role. They were able to soften the boycott and give everyone cover by saying, you know, if you were to find some British product in a house, the person could easily say, "Oh no! You know, I'm doing the boycott. This is stolen or smuggled, as John Adams or James Madison said. This is smuggled or plundered British tea. It's the best."
Yeah, and the other piece of this is, you know, because the attention shifts to the warfare, to warfare, it's not embarrassing that the boycott doesn't work. So the most striking element of the boycott collapse, and many of the different provisions in the association end at different times. The Congress responds to the ban on tea consumption by realizing that it's so widely violated that they reauthorize tea consumption just a few months before independence. And the logic for authorizing it is, well, it's so widely violated, we might as well do so. And it's not embarrassing. It's not a climb down, because by April of 1776, when they do this, when they're debating the Declaration of Independence, when they've been fighting war for nearly a year, the tea thing is no longer central to politics in any way. And so they can, in fact, the boycott as a whole is no longer central. It's winning the war against Britain that is the central political concern. Everything else you can win or lose. If you lose the war, it doesn't matter. So the politics of the moment allow to accept defeat on this provision of the boycott without it even feeling like a defeat or seeming like a defeat, because the real battle is still ahead of them and still in front of them. And people can feel like they are participating meaningfully in the struggle, not by choosing to not to consume a certain good, but by joining the Continental Army, by joining a militia, by sewing and repairing clothes for the Continental Army, by supplying them, by being the kind of merchants who acquire the supplies for the army. So all of this is a much more meaningful way to participate. They're already having commemorative events. General Montgomery died at Quebec City on December 31st of 1775 on the American attack on that city. And so his death was widely commemorated as a great loss. Going to those sorts of commemorative events becomes more important than politically, in terms of a sense of creating common cause, than whether you drink tea or Jamaican coffee or you wear British manufactured cloth. So the boycott ends quietly.
Yeah. Of the many things you could do to support the cause, obviously another thing that you might do if you're a sailor is to join a privateering ship or join the budding Continental Navy, which starts with just the single ship, I believe, and then carries on. So just want to talk about a little bit about sort of the budding American privateering force and the Continental Navy.
Mm-hmm. There are a couple pieces to this. There's a Continental Navy. George Washington's army has his own navy that's separate from the Continental Navy. It's very British of the Americans to have these multiple bureaucratically separate duplicating versions of the same thing. South Carolina and Connecticut and Massachusetts all have their own navies. I suspect other colonies did too. And then states, individual states, as well as the continental government could also license privateers. So this creates a lot of space for what's going on. And for some of the logic of this, you can sort of think, if you're South Carolina, early Continental Navy vessels, not all of them go as close to South Carolina as the South Carolinians would want to protect their coast. And so they need to supplement that with some naval vessels that are meant to stay closer to their area. And other regions will do the same. One interesting case, there is the Andrea Doria, which is a famous early American naval vessel made famous by Barbara Tuchman in her book, The First Salute, talks about the first when the American Navy first gets saluted by a foreign power in St. Eustatius. And it did a raid on the Bahamas earlier, and it also seized enemy cargoes. It was a naval vessel. It wasn't a privateer, but it seized enemy shipping when and where it could and tended to run away from bigger British ships, which was, of course, a strategically sound thing to do. And so it sat in this weird middle space between being, it was officially a naval vessel, but it had privateering-ish duties because its duties were either to chase away enemy privateers or attack enemy privateers. And if you successfully attacked a British privateer, it might have valuable cargo, which would then be prized to the naval vessel, and the captain and the government and the crew would take shares. And then I was looking in the Philadelphia newspapers, and it comes back to Philadelphia, and there's an advertisement listing by name 15 people who the vessel had taken, who were enslaved persons, who were going to be auctioned because they were also the loot that were taken from enemy, from British shipping. But the captain wasn't really sure if they were slaves or not. And so he was advertising and saying, does anybody know who these people are? And so he weirdly lists them by name. Slaves, of course, enslaved people are so often not given by name, but merely by number. And so this is this odd naming of all these people saying, please come to the court. The prize court will meet on this day. And so here in Philadelphia, not just a few blocks from where the first abolitionist society in North America is meeting, is they're going to auction off these 15 people from the U.S. Navy. So these are Congress's slaves that they've taken after just saying they're not going to do the slave trade. And no one sees this as a contradiction. Of course, this is just how privateering works in their minds. So they proceed that way. And there would have, when you think it through, how many other opportunities like this are there? Raiding the Bahamas. The Bahamas has a large enslaved population. Major military operations in other colonies in the Caribbean and elsewhere provide opportunities for this. I read an early survey by another scholar of American privateering and British slaving, and it put over 10,000 people taken off of British ships by American licensed privateers, many of whom were entirely French crewed vessels operating out of Martinique and then selling them on into the French slave trade. I suspect that number is substantially higher than 10,000, probably north of 20,000, because the British slave trade was so big that there were so many targets. So there's this way in which privateering and the Navy vessels, the privateers gravitate toward the Caribbean, and the American Navy does that a lot less because there's more important strategic targets to occupy. But, you know, this weird overlap between commerce and naval activity, famously, right, this is how the Americans win the Battle of Yorktown. The British Navy is late to Yorktown, and so it cannot relieve the siege of Washington's siege of Cornwallis's army. And Washington's siege works because the French Navy is blockading Yorktown by sea, and the British Navy is stuck in the Caribbean shaking down the people from St. Eustatius because they've just taken St. Eustatius, and Admiral Rodney is busy making sure that all the people are fully deprived, that he can deprive of their money, are fully deprived. He spends about 3 months emptying the pockets of everyone he can on the island, including all the Americans and loyalists that are there, that he has, like, he also very suspicious of some of the loyalists, right? And so he invites the French from neighboring islands over, with whom he's at war, right, to come over to St. Eustatius to buy the property that he auctions off of the Americans on the island. And they come over on flag of truce and they go back. And of course, he lines his pocket substantially in doing so. And missed Yorktown, but, you know, so there's a trade-off there sometimes that you can't always predict.
I'm struck by that number, 10,000 or 20,000 enslaved people captured by American privateers. And I was connecting that to the comment you made about the Continental Association that banned the slave trade. And of course, then thirdly, we have that deleted passage from a draft of the Declaration of Independence, which we've talked about in previous episodes, where Jefferson excoriates King George, selling people who've done nothing to him, and, you know, continuing this appalling traffic in human beings. You mentioned earlier in this episode the Zorg ship with the tragedy of throwing 100 enslaved people overboard just so they could make it, and it was a privateered captured ship. I'm just trying to get a sense of all of this and how this fits into some of the wider arguments or discussions we have about the complex feelings about, on the one hand, slavery, and then the slave trade and the various ways that, say, someone like Jefferson was trying to create some distinction between the trading of slaves and the having of slaves.
Yeah, that's a good question. We've tilted at that windmill for some time. I want to reframe it a little bit. Okay. I think maybe the more useful way to think about it is the Declaration of Independence made the United States a country. And it didn't just make the United States a country. It made the United States a normal country. The Declaration of Independence sometimes has an implicit way in which we read it as feeding into an American exceptionalism. And of course, you mentioned earlier the ideological significance of the revolution, and the Declaration is part of that. But it made the United States a normal country in the sense that it was led by politicians who would say what needed to be said for political advantage, either in their careers or for the political advantage of their state. And in that, they were very normal. That is a normal thing for politicians to do. It is, such hypocrisy is normative in European politics of the 18th century. There is nothing at all unusual about it. So the idea that Jefferson would own slaves and also try to blame King George for them is normal hypocrisy. Is normally hypocritical? Is hypocritically normal? I'm not sure which way to put that. It makes sense. It doesn't make any sense. And in that way, it makes perfect sense, because the 18th century is all about this kind of contradiction. They also don't have these totalizing states that we think of in the 20th century, where everything is supposed to be coherent and make sense from the top down in some way. So that part's normal. And it was normal for great European powers, or great European Atlantic powers, to have the slave trade, to have slave owning in their Atlantic colonies, at least the ones in which it was profitable and practical to do so. And so when North America became dependent as the United States, it became normal in that way too. And the horrifying story of the Zong, where I think it's like 180, I think it's the total dead. I don't recall the exact number. The privateering the Americans did against the British. The British privateered against the Americans, but there wasn't an American slave trade to attack. Otherwise, they would have. So they privateered the French one. And sometimes they got American slave traders. I was reading the British High Court of Admiralty records, and they caught at sea, they caught an American vessel, and it had a passenger on it, William Vernon, who was on the Continental Navy Board and was a major figure in the Continental, organizing and funding the Continental Navy, and was also a major Rhode Island slave trader. And Vernon came with, as he insisted to the British, his free servant, who was therefore not a slave and therefore couldn't be seized as enemy property, according to Vernon, because this servant was not a slave. But he was one of the biggest slave traders in Rhode Island, so I'm really, really sure that it was a slave and he was just lying about it. And the British thought he was lying about it, and so they didn't believe him. And they also let him go because, being a British bureaucracy, they couldn't think through the logic of keeping him long enough to be bothered. And so he left and goes back to North America. So this sort of little messiness of his story is an example of the way in which North Americans had slaves, and the British could try to take them every now and then. The French did, and the British did that as well. But it's striking that during the Revolutionary Wars, the British and French each took one or two islands from each other in the Caribbean, and they kept all the workers working on these islands and in slave conditions, producing sugar and other crops for export. They just changed where the cargoes went and changed whose pockets got lined. But the game and the system stayed in place. And so I think that's one thing that stays fundamental, is the system as a whole isn't undermined by the revolution. The white power slavery system, the system of transatlantic capitalism, this is not at all undermined by the revolution. And privateering draws upon that system and leverages it, in fact, right? So one of the struggles we have when we have things like the 1619 Project is it often, for some participants, it has a U.S.-centered view in which we're not seeing the larger system that it's a part of. And that larger system, the United States, remains a very normal participant. In fact, well into the 19th century, you could argue the American South remained informally an economic colony of Britain, hardly dependent at all. All those bales of cotton, majority of American exports, a bare majority in 1860, 70% of it went to Britain. And this was why Britain almost intervened on the Confederacy's behalf in the Civil War. So the economic relationship with Britain survives the war, intensifies with the cotton gin in the years after the war, and with the growth of British manufacturing. So in many ways, the United States was normal in that way too. That experience is normal of actually much of South America in the 19th century.
Yeah, fascinating. What you were saying about the system staying the same helped me now understand what we were talking about with the Brotherhood of the Sea, that the sailors would still sail for whomever. They had no animosity towards each other. You would capture an island, but let's keep the enslaved people working. You know, there's just this very powerful economic subset of all the decision-making that's going on. And it's just like, well, no, we're not going to screw up this great money-making thing we've got right here going. We're just going to do it. And it sort of summed up perfectly in a remarkable way in that story of Vernon's servant. Like, he was saying, no, this is not a commodity. This is a human being, right? So you can't take him as you would a sack of coffee or a sack of sugar. And because of the complexities of this world where enslaved people are in fact commodities, they're just like, no, we reject this. This human being is in fact a commodity, not a free person. And it's just remarkable. And stories like that always blow my mind. So thank you for that little historical tidbit.
It's funny because Vernon's and his fellows from Rhode Island, you know, they have been slave trading to the Caribbean. And when the ban on trade with the Caribbean began, the way the slave trade worked is you delivered enslaved human captives for sale to the Caribbean, and you received payment a year or two later. So when the ban on trade with the Caribbean happened, you had all these Rhode Island merchants who had lent money to the British Caribbean, especially to Jamaica, and needed to send ships down to collect payment, which would be in the form of sugar or in the form of bills of exchange or other banknotes drawn on England. And so they kind of still needed to go to Jamaica in 1775 and 6 and even 1777 to get paid for things they did in 74 and 75. And so Vernon, on the one hand, is on the Navy board. And on the other hand, he's got this huge pile of IOUs. One of his fellow Rhode Islanders, Aaron Lopez, even gets to successfully petitions Congress for permission to send a ship to Jamaica in 1780 to load up on supplies to pay him what he's owed. And Congress agrees, but the poor man keeps on getting his ships taken by privateers from both sides because they keep thinking, well, no, you're an American. And I said, no, you're selling to Jamaica. You're British, so we'll attack you. So he's trying to thread the needle, but he's getting it from both sides because of the system that he's a part of.
What a messy business, and so fascinating. And I'm so happy you talked to me and talk to all of us about this fascinating and wild world of privateering. Professor Fischer, we've come to the end of our discussion today. I ask all my guests just to tell me about their main takeaways. Here you are, 250 years after the Declaration of Independence. What do you think when you think about this anniversary?
You know, it's a funny question. I teach in Hong Kong, and I live here, where I have for some time. And 250 years is a good run for, say, a Chinese dynasty. So 250 years is a long time in that way, right? And so when I talk about the Declaration of Independence now and the emergence of the United States, I sort of think about it as it exists as one government that has existed, at least in 1789, for 200 plus years, which is a lengthy period of time. But when the Declaration of Independence happened, it was a very different document and existed in a very different world that's so fundamentally different from ours. We can try to make a way that we understand it, that the people are recognizable to us. They're humane in their hypocrisy. They're cruel in their humanity. These are things that we are too. But at the same time, it represented a world in which nothing was totalized like 20th and the 21st century world was. It represented a world before political parties existed in any meaningful way. The parties of North America before the revolution were little cliques and clans. And so in many ways, you know, while we sort of see it as the founding of the United States, it was also so much of a different era that it is, as much as it connects to us today, it's fundamentally disconnected from us because it is of this different era, the era of when men dressed differently, when people spoke differently, when they acted and ate differently, and the world was just different.
Professor James Fischer, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americacentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americacentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americacentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americacentrum.de. Thanks for listening.